Hello out there, Channel 9. This is Paul DiCarlo here at the Microsoft Store in the Houston Galleria, and I am being presented with a special guest from right here in H-Town, the infamous and famous Scott Peterson of Liquid Daffodil, who's going to be sharing with us some insights on his experiences with Microsoft technology over almost three decades now.
That is
interesting. So how does one start with that? You know, you do the math here. That means you've been a developer since the 80s.
I started writing software in 1989, and so it was a bit of a fluke. So up until that point, I'm 50 years old now, and so I was pretty young at that point, but up until that point, the only software that I had written was in my junior year of high school. They had a room that had a bunch of Apple IIe computers. You remember that?
Gotcha.
With the black screen
Oregon
and the orange.
Trail machines, yeah.
Yes, exactly, an orange thing. And I thought at the time one of the biggest video games out was a game called Joust. So I don't know if you remember Joust, but it had a little birds that you flap, and I thought, what a great, cool thing that I could try and do. So I actually recreated Joust on this little Apple IIe computer back then. And that's all that I had done. And then I was in property management in the West in the late 80s, and I had a buddy of mine that was in Phoenix that was internal with Microsoft and was on this Thunder beta that he talked about. And
okay.
You know now that the Thunder was the...
So this was the code word.
The code word that ended up being VB10. And of course, at the time, I had no idea that it was even going to be important. But in property management, I had taken this crazy initiative to get all of these people in our property management company who were doing everything on paper. I said, why don't you start doing all of this in Lotus 1-2-3 macros?
Yes.
So for those of you that remember Lotus 1-2-3, and it was this huge initiative to put it into macros. And when I got done with that, I thought, man, it'd be really cool just to write some property management software. So I hooked up with
my buddy
in Phoenix. And so now it was cool because I wasn't just going to play with VB. I actually had some actual business requirements to create an app in VB1. So I worked with him, and there were some bugs and some issues, and went back and forth, and I actually created what I know now is probably, honestly, almost $1 million property management system in VB1.
Oh, wow.
And so it was actually terrible. Because I'd never written software, but so that's how I got my start. I wrote some property management software before you could even connect VB to a database.
Okay, so this is interesting, and so this is way back the original edition of VB, so I imagine perceived a little bit differently than today. So this was the whiz-bang, like, awesome technology of the day. I think that's cool that you kind of started off with something that was, you know, like, siloed as a code project, that sort of thing. Do you still find yourself dealing with emerging technologies today?
Yeah, absolutely. So this has been something that's really been different with me. So for a number of years, especially in the mid to late 90s, I'd had some experience, and that was a time in software development where it was still easier to get a software developer job if you actually had written software.
Gotcha.
Versus having a degree. So if you took a guy who had his PhD in computer science versus a guy like me who'd actually written software for 6 months, I would get the job.
Interesting.
See, so I was able to have a lot of early success, and I moved into the consulting world and started writing software with Deloitte & Touche for a while as a consulting group. And so here's how I'm answering that question. One of the biggest things that was difficult for me in writing software for a company, an organization, was they didn't want to adopt new stuff. Right?
Oh, yeah,
I wanted to be doing leading edge, bleeding edge, and so so there'd be a business case, right? So the general requirements would get created by a client.
Sure.
I would bring a proposed solution to them, and if I was using technologies that were not really tried and true, like been around for 2 or 3 years,
right,
and a number of other companies before us have created them, people weren't interested, and I could understand why not. But so I realized very quickly that wasn't a good fit for me. At the time, I wanted to be doing all kinds of cool things. For example, I remember being at Compaq in the mid-90s, and there was a big challenge for us to get Microsoft Visual InterDev installed. So do you remember InterDev?
That is not one I'm familiar with.
So InterDev eventually became Visual Studio.
So okay.
InterDev.
There we go. The history.
Microsoft InterDev there was this crazy idea at this at the time in the mid-90s. So we were actually building Compaq's first online shopping at the time.
Oh,
so
nice.
Compaq
wow.
was in a race with Dell. Right? Who's going to do it? Dell actually won, by the way. But this race for Dell, and we were building their first online shopping, and my job was to create the configuration engine part of that. So basically, you say, I want this computer, it can have this graphics card, but if I change the RAM, then it has to do this, and right, it's all this logic for this configuration engine. And Visual InterDev had this great way for you not just to create websites, but had this new cool thing called MTS, Microsoft, or Transaction Server and DCOM. This is what we first used, and the idea was so crazy at the time. The idea was we could actually write code that would run on another server, and then we could create VB components that would call that component on another server.
Okay.
And so it's a really...
Sure.
As this was really out there, not trusted by very many people. Compaq ended up letting us actually do that. And so we wrote this solution using Visual InterDev. This whole idea that we would have components on other computers that would talk to a database and things like that, that was just really great. And so I got my taste finally of having been able to put leading edge technology into a real corporation, a real solution.
Okay.
And I said, hey, maybe I can keep doing this. And so that's what I've done. Always tried to adopt the newest things. And still am doing that today.
Well, that's the great thing about being in the technology space, right? There's always a new thing to play with. So the question becomes, how do you determine the next new thing that you're going to play with? So, like, I know you've done some things in some of these areas, for example, some Microsoft band development, some mobile application development. What drives that? Is it your passion for the device that you're targeting, or are you looking more at what are the consumers looking at? And I'm going to go for the thing that everybody's looking at.
Yeah.
Right?
So that's a great question. And I think the biggest thing is that the biggest thing that I've noticed about me is that I absolutely try everything. So you'll see a news, you'll see something internal say Microsoft this, or here's something that's happening. And I remember this when Office Graph, for example, was first released.
Sure.
This whole idea of Office Graph. Everything that comes up, I go out immediately and I spend a number of days trying to figure out where can I leverage this new idea, tool, or technology in a way that would really make sense. And sometimes I get these ideas from my own life, right? I'm thinking, I can see a business case for this in my home or in my neighborhood or in my business. Or sometimes I may have solutions that I had written 3 or 4 years ago.
Sure.
Where I say, oh my gosh, if I only had this, right?
Right.
Then I would have been able to solve that problem. But I actually go out and I spend a number of days just really trying to make sure that I can understand it and always write some sample code.
Sure.
And so this is what's even happened with some of the newer initiatives, like with Power BI and Flow, for example.
Okay.
I found that I'm actually honestly a little frustrated currently because Flow, the whole concept behind Flow, which is similar to if this then that sort of things, it's a little limiting now because I can't actually do anything other than create flows. Like the developers don't have a lot of control yet.
I see.
So I was able to go out and evaluate Flow is awesome. Power BI is awesome. Making these sort of things and these power apps and connecting that with Flow, this is phenomenal. But I started to realize that I don't have the control over that yet. So now I'm saying, okay, 6 months, right? 3 months or 6 months, maybe I'll be able to do a lot more with that.
Well, one of the things I find really interesting, especially with some of those technologies you're mentioning, is they can be additive to existing solutions. And when I say additive, I'm saying looking at the technology, because obviously technology can be additive to a business, you know, having an online storefront or that sort of thing, it adds a new dimension to your ability to reach customers. But let's look at how, like, you can take some of these technologies, for example, some of the cognitive services that we've seen, and you can add those into or on top of existing applications to get some sort of an additive benefit out of that, right? So, like, perhaps you have a database functionality and now you want to have natural language processing to be able to search it, or maybe natural language to perhaps peruse your Office Graph, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about some of those things? So when we come up with these technologies, do you feel these additive technologies are something that would benefit most technology if it was to be adopted?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we used a couple of really good examples. So I've had the benefit of having some pieces of software that I created 20 years ago, I'm still maintaining them now. I'm still creating new versions of those 20 years later. And this, what you explained, is exactly what happens. I don't even have a requirement for a feature, but then something like the language understanding stuff that's coming out with Luis or with bot technology, I'm now able to say, oh my gosh, if I can integrate these services in this vertical solution, a vertical solution, industry vertical solution, wow, this would absolutely open up all kinds of doors. And a lot of times what's funny is there's kind of a pre-validation that's already been done, because when stuff, especially with cognitive services, when I understand kind of how the pieces are fitting together, I realize that I've already tried to do that myself for 5 years or 10 years to try and create what now is being offered to me as a service without writing virtually.
So now you've just got a platform there, right?
Yeah. Which you can, so, you know, it's that same thing where somebody said, oh my gosh, where was this in 2008, right? Or where was this in 2010? Or even some of this, where was this in 2015? We're seeing some stuff in 2016 related to cognitive services that wasn't even available a year ago. It's really powerful.
And that's totally the thing. And who knows what's going to come out there, right? So looking at some of your developer work, like you are prolific. You probably have in the number of, I'd say you've hit a million downloads across the board on
so we actually
apps.
Yeah. So we actually have an app that I think was either the first or one of the first third party apps to get a million downloads in the Windows Store.
Oh, nice.
And so it's kind of a fun little story about that. So when I first got a Windows Phone 7. We had a neighbor a couple miles away that had a Windows phone, and I thought, you know what, not very many people have these, brand new on the market. I thought it'd be really cool to have a little app that would just show you where other Windows phone users were around, so originally around my neighborhood or around Texas, and eventually it became the world. And so I created this app that was just called I'm a WP7. So it came out, it was called I'm a WP7, and after it was out for a month or two, I started to get people from all over the world. So I released it to the world. I got people from all over the world that said, you know, it'd be really nice if we could talk to each other. So I added messaging, or it'd be really nice if we could have wallpapers. So I added wallpapers or ringtones. It'd be really nice if we could have forums. So it was one of the apps that had the first Windows Phone only forum. It was very heavily used forum. It had ended up having games and ended up having all kinds of things. And then shortly before Windows Phone 8 came out, we said, oh, crud, we're going to have to change the name. Windows, and so we didn't want to keep doing I'm a WP7, I'm a WP8. And there was an app that was out by Microsoft called Windows Insider. So we said, we're going to call this Windows Outsider. And it became Outsider, which eventually became one of the first and still one of the few social third-party apps that has reached a million downloads from a third-party developer in that era.
So you won't believe this. I'm actually one of the original users of I'm a WP7, believe it or not. And what I found really interesting about it is, looking back, you were on to some forward-thinking thought process there with the development of your app. And I think there's a reason why, and I'll kind of hint on that. But it did. It had all these chat features in there. It was sort of like Yik Yak and those sort of applications. A lot of this, the stuff you're seeing in the social world now where it's kind of privatized, right, amongst some sort of a community on the platform, this app had all of that way back when. And so what I think you're kind of hinting at here, you start talking about how you're getting all these feature requests and stuff like that from users. Are the users dictating to you what kind of application they want the application to be?
Yes, they are. And so that I think that's a really important point. Because so Liquid Daffodil, if my count is right, has had 14 top downloaded paid apps thus far in the Windows stores. That's a lot of different
apps. Oh, yeah.
And that's actually in 7 or 8 different categories. So these are different types of apps, right?
So we're not taking a mold.
Health and fitness and social and music, and we've got all these different apps. But invariably what happens is that I think of some small app idea, and what I learned early on is that I make it really easy for the users to communicate with me. I always put in some scenario, have a feature request, let us know right now. You want something changed? Let us know right now. And that's what happened with Outsider. So it started as a little tiny thing, and the users said, this is what we want. And here's what's so cool about that, Paul, is when the users say, this is what we want, and then they have a developer say, that's a great idea, let me see what I can do. Because it can't always happen.
Right.
But when they say, that's a great idea, let me see what I can do, and then the next week, that feature shows up in the app. See, that life cycle is so short. And then what happens is then now they feel ownership. Not just ownership in that feature, but now ownership in that app. And now they start saying, hey, you know, I asked for that feature, right? And so there's this big community of people who felt ownership in Outsider because they were in charge of making sure it got those features. That's actually how games ended up in Outsider. Outsider actually had a couple of games in there. People said, I want a free game, that nobody else can play, but people in my hive. So I don't know if you...
That's right, the concept of hives, yes.
And so this is what we added to that.
So that was one of the other things, too. In addition to, I recall a lot of your apps, because I've actually used multiples of them, you always have these really ingenious terms, I think, for things. So, like, you used hives to define your collections of groups of people that had Windows phones. And I remember on Gleek, just even calling it Gleek, you turned Twitter upside down. This was a Twitter client. So if you want to go into some
Gleek's actually a pretty fun story, and I'm going to have to say right off the bat that it's actually pronounced Gluck.
Oh, Gluck.
So, okay. No, Gluck.
Gluck.
So I've almost never, isn't it?
It's not an E.
Yes,
it's upside
two,
down
two of them. I've actually almost never shared that with people, but here's what happened. At the time, there were a couple of really great Twitter apps, two of them.
Rowie was in there.
Rowie was in there and Carbon was in there.
Okay.
So Rowie and Carbon, two great apps. I think Rowie was developed by some great folks that were even internal at my club. Two really great apps. And I had a number of people come to me and say, these are really great apps, but they're a little boring. See, so they said, we're using them, we love them, they got great support, they got great features, but they're just a little bit boring.
Sure.
And these are people that came from the Outsider group, right? So they knew that there's a bunch of crazy fun things that could be done. They said, we would love it if you would create a Twitter app that wasn't boring. So I went through a number of iterations on app names. It was originally called Tweester with
Tweester.
Schwaz, and there's a number of variations. But I came up with that because I wanted it to, number one, be noticeable, and I wanted it to be a little strange, and I wanted it to be silly. And so I created, at the time, using Carbon as the model, I created Gleek, or Gluck,
nice.
Or Gleek, because Carbon was a well-designed app. The problem is the Carbon developers had to go away. They couldn't support it, they had to go away. So this was kind of a replacement for that. But to date, this has still been the app that's gotten the most publicity, even though it never got the downloads. At the time, it spent a lot of time being the number one Twitter app for the Windows platform. But this is a scenario where, again, the users were able to decide what they want to have be in there. So here's a couple of quick examples. They wanted to... they noticed a lot of Verge articles at that time. You know, the easing Verge. They noticed that a lot of these Verge articles would blame a bunch of stuff on Microsoft that wasn't Microsoft's fault. So I put into Gleek, I put in Verge mode, which basically when you shift it into Verge mode, every error that happens on the back end from Twitter, the app blames on Microsoft. So it was called Verge mode. And then I had a number of other features like that. And actually, that's just one of four of our Twitter apps that we put out there. In my opinion, it's not necessarily the best one, but that's still the one of two apps that every single week we get people saying, I wish you'd bring that back.
And that's one of the things, for those of you out there, if you haven't tried any Liquid Daffodil apps, there really is these, I guess, nuances. It's almost like a niche feature. How you add these things in, what they do sometimes, is very, very creative. You'll kind of notice this work throughout the majority of the apps that are produced through Liquid Daffodil. And so on top of that, one of the other things I noticed is really interesting, you seem to have a way built into your applications to communicate with your users. Like, that is something that most of your apps just inherently have. And I'm curious, what gave you that idea in the first place, and what advantages has that perhaps given you in terms of, you know, your perceived ability to both deliver to your users, but also communicate with them?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it wasn't always that way. This is one of the things that I learned the hard way. So there's a couple of things that I learned maybe in the first 18 months to 2 years that we were creating apps. Number one, I learned that if people feel confused in the beginning, they'll stop using an app and uninstall it.
Okay.
Number two, if they don't feel like they can easily get a question answered, they will uninstall it, never use
okay.
it, and then also never recommend it or unrecommend it. And then number
three, just the death spiral. Yeah.
Yep. And then number three, if you don't make it real easy for them to get their questions answered related to issues, problems, bugs, defects, errors that are happening, if you don't get them that information very quickly, the same thing will happen. There's a,
sure.
there's a very low tolerance for users to put up with bad performing apps for honestly more than a number of hours, actually. So if you have so I've noticed that most users, if they send you a problem, hey, something's not working, or I noticed this is happening, or it's crashing, if they don't get a response in 2 days or 3 days, they will actually have already uninstalled the app. They will have already probably posted on social networks Uh-oh. That it was terrible that it didn't happen. And at the time, also, the mechanism for feedback in the store was just rudimentary. So someone could leave a terrible review. They could say, this thing is horrible, so, and I experienced this a lot. I love this thing, it's excellent, 5 stars. I love this, it's excellent, 5 stars. Then another guy said, this thing is horrible. Don't
right.
ever do it one
Yelp
star.
Effect. Yeah.
Well, I always thought, well, dang, I'd love to help that guy have a better experience. How can I do it? And I realized, unless I put an easy mechanism within the apps, they can't, right?
That's
and so even a lot of folks will say, use user voice, which is a great scenario for tracking bugs and things like that. The problem with user voice is that the user in the moment doesn't feel special.
Gotcha.
They feel like they're contributing to the greater good, but they don't feel special. And when people email me, this isn't just a technique, this is really how I feel. When people email me and they need something, or they have a question on something, or they want a feature, or they've had a horrible experience, in that moment, for that 30 seconds or 45 seconds, I actually really care. So you laugh, but
right.
it's true. I really do care, and so then I care and I respond, and I've noticed that that has had phenomenal results, especially for apps like FanBan. I don't know if you've gone out and seen FanBan. FanBan.
So that's your application.
So
the
that's
Microsoft
the Microsoft Band.
Band.
It has stayed the top health and fitness download since it was released in the United States. So still today, if you go out to the store, it's the top health and fitness download. And if you look at the reviews, here's what you'll notice about the reviews, because I've decided to use that as my model. Care about the people,
right.
care about the users. That's just my core philosophy, care about
and
the users.
And you don't have an arm devoted to this. This is
no,
you.
No, no, this is
They're
me.
They're talking to the guy
this,
writing the code.
Yeah, this is me sending them the reply, and me usually sending the reply while my wife says, come to bed, right? It's enough, that's enough already, come to bed. But if you'll go and look at the reviews of FanBan, what you'll notice that's different than a lot of other apps is it's not just 5 stars and great or 4 stars and great. You've got people that give it 5 stars and then they give you a paragraph or two paragraphs about why they love the app. They almost always mention the developer was so responsive.
Gotcha.
And here's the part behind the scenes, that behind the story that a lot of people don't know, is a lot of those people may have at one point been someone who was very upset, some disgruntled user who gave me 1 star, and I went out and said, man, I hate that you've had that experience. Could you email me and we'll figure out a way to make you happy? And so in the matter of a day or 2 days, very often that 1 star unhappy user becomes a 5 star happy user devoted for life.
And no, this is verifiable. I know because I used to watch your development at the time when I was a phone developer myself with a top performing app. And I just could not figure out how it was, the Liquid Daffodil. Like, if you read your reviews on some of your apps, I mean, they are, like you said, people fall in love with your apps, it kind of seems like. And I love this explanation of why. So you're kind of pointing out there that maybe they're disgruntled with a previous experience for maybe a not-so-responsive developer. And what's really cool, too, is to kind of see, when you explain this why, I'm sorry, it starts to make sense, like, why did the Windows Phone Store change its format now, right, where you can actually converse with the developer now. I don't know if you knew that, but mm-hmm. the consumer can now converse easier, and that wasn't there before. In fact, you had to build your own infrastructure for that back in the Phone 7, probably early Phone 8 days as well. That's really, really interesting to see that your success kind of gets pulled out into something that's tried to be adopted along with the greater infrastructure. So on that note, it sounds like you know how to build a community. What is the current or next community you're planning on building or looking at perhaps taking a emerging technology and playing with to perhaps get some fortune and fame?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think it's really going to be around the Microsoft Band and health and fitness stuff is really the direction that I'm still moving. So our three top apps right now, if you were to go out and say, what are they, you know, ones that are either top downloader in the top 10 are FanBand, which we talked about before, which is purely a theming app, right? Purely a theming app, but people love it. Quartanium, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but Quartanium has the most, is a top download in the Windows PC store.
Okay.
And Quartanium has the deepest Cortana integration of any app in the market. So if you're not familiar with Quartanium, you should check it out.
Okay, what is the elevator pitch for Quartanium?
So Quartanium says, here's a whole bunch of things that Cortana can't do yet, and I'm actually adding those actions and activities and tasks into the app. So for an example, you could pull out your phone or your PC and you could say, hey, what's my horoscope?
Okay.
Or you could say, hey, you could say, hey, please insult me, for example. So Cortana can insult you. Or I've used some really cool techniques and actually been able to leverage pieces of the OS that were unusable before. For example, I can even tell my PC, hey, restart.
Nice.
Hey, log off. Or hey, change to dark theme. So, you know, Windows 10 has a dark theme. A lot of people don't know that. If you don't know how to make the registry changes, you can't change to dark theme, but with Cortanium, you can change it to dark theme. Or, this is what's...
And you're saying something that would require a registry change, I just speak to the computer and this happens?
You just speak to the computer and it happens. And here's a couple of the other cool things.
That's a good idea.
So there's band integration in there as well, so I could ask Cortana. Now, a bunch of that's already coming into Cortana now, but at the time you couldn't say, how many steps have I taken in the last 8 hours? But there's also Fitbit integration. So you can actually get Fitbit information from Cortana by using Cortanium. You could say things like, show me everything my manager's working on, and it'll go out to SharePoint and tell you what your manager's working on from SharePoint using the Office Graph.
That's cool.
Or you can say, tell me what's trending on Twitter, and it'll actually show you the hashtags in your region that are trending on Twitter. So that's about 40 cool commands.
So with this, you've hit something here. That sounds amazing. That's a lot of stuff.
Yes.
How does a user know that that's what they can do with your app?
So sometimes they don't. So the answer is sometimes they don't. This is where I have to really refine the initial experience. I'm getting better at defining that initial experience. You know, the first 5 to 8 minutes that a user is in an app once they download it.
They're learning, right?
Yes. And I realize that I know everything that that app does, but the person who's downloading it usually knows almost nothing.
Right.
In fact, I've found that most users actually don't even read the content in the description. They just say, everybody loves it. This looks fun, and they download it. So one thing that I've done in Cortanium is I've actually made it so Cortana will tell you what you can do from within Cortana. So for example, you could go to the information about Foursquare, and Cortana will then tell you how to use the Foursquare feature. So you could say, hey, check me in.
Okay.
So that's the feature. So I would be sitting here and it would say, and it would check us in at the Microsoft store in the Galleria in Houston, Texas. But I can just on my phone say, hey, check me in, and Cortani will check you in. Well, if you don't know quite how to do that, Cortana in Cortanium will give you examples of how to use it. So she'll say, you can say, hey, please check me in, or say, check me in.
So again, this is an example, like I said, Liquid Daffodil, that's always creative. So you're saying you use Cortana is your help manual.
Yes, yes. So
you, things like this. That's what I'm saying. You got to check this guy's work out. It's excellent.
So the other thing I was going to say, because the question you really asked is, what's the next sort of like...
the big thing.
The big thing. I don't know, but we have an app called Bandsider that is a takeoff of Outsider. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
Okay.
But this is for only band users worldwide. So do you remember how Outsider was for only Windows Phone users?
Right.
Bandsider is only for band users worldwide. So now if you get down on Bandsider, you can talk band to band. So I could communicate with people that have Microsoft Band around the world.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah.
Like
I can get information.
Spy watch, right?
Yeah, I can do all kinds of stuff using Bandsider. It has tons of tools. I can check my location. I can even find my phone. So that's actually just found my phone from my Microsoft Band.
You press the button on the band and you find your phone. I'm downloading that when I get out.
Yeah, so there's all kinds of tools. There's Find My Phone. That's also getting forms, but that has messaging, that has, it integrates all the Microsoft Health blog news. You have challenges, and they're not just challenges like other social networks. You actually have like karma challenges even. So, for example, you may have a pay it forward challenge or a donate your t-shirts challenge. So these are challenges that band users can achieve even when they're 75 or 80 years old.
Now this karma thing, something's flickering here. You had a mechanism like that in Gluck, correct? Correct.
Yeah. So I've had a number of scenarios where users have loved certain apps so much that they've said, I wish we could pay you more. Now I know that this seems like a silly thing, but this actually has happened where users have said, we love Gleek. It's always called Gleek. We love Gleek, we love Fan Banner, we love Outsider so much that we wish we know it's probably a lot of work. You give great support. How can we give you more money? Really is what they're saying. And so what we have within a number of our apps is what we call a good karma donation. And I'm guessing that's what you're referring
Correct.
To? Yes. So the good karma donation basically says you pick your level, $5, $10, $20, $25. You make just a good karma donation. We know automatically that some of that's going to go to Microsoft. Some of that will go to us. But our attitude is that these people now are getting ownership and creating good karma for themselves.
Gotcha.
That's the concept. You're helping a developer, you're loving a developer by contributing a few dollars here, and our attitude is it's going to come back to you just like it's come back to us.
So it's almost like a gamification mechanism that you kind of have running throughout these applications. Which, you know, it's like each one of these just small things that you kind of incorporate in there, I could go into detail about. I just think it's really phenomenal how you've taken your development in technologies. Most of the stuff's brand new. You take the plunge, and then you almost have this tried and true method now over the last few years with the mobile space to be able to know how to both build, maintain a community, maintain downloads, maintain reputation. I think that's a really big skill that gets kind of lost in the consumer space, right? Because usually the developer builds a thing and they're like, it works, okay? Unreproducible on my machine.
Yeah,
right?
Works on my machine.
Works on my machine. And so I think that's really, really cool. And I think that's something that a lot of, you know, regardless of the platform you're on, I think some of these tips that you're giving here are very, very valuable for how you create it. The other thing I think that's amazing is how big is the software development team at Liquid Daffodil? I know this answer, but.
So it's just me.
It's just one guy,
it's
right?
Just me. And so the other part of that is that I actually don't do this for a living. So I'm actually a corporate developer. So I don't know if you know this, but I create software for gas and oil companies and mostly a SharePoint developer, which I have there's a lot of confluence between those. And so I'm actually a corporate developer, and that's what I do for a living. And all the apps I'm doing because I love doing it. So
that's
even
cool.
though I'm making money doing it, and even though I love doing it, it's not my primary role or responsibility. But the great thing about the Microsoft Tools and Technologies, and this has happened, in fact, it probably happened with FanBan, is that I had an idea. I was done with my work for the day. I had an idea, so I probably created it that night or then the next morning and published it to the App Store. And it was available, you know, in a day or two.
Right.
That's what's actually possible to do.
Mass distribution through a store environment to seemingly
from my idea, so from my idea to the ability for anyone in the entire world to download it and use it with their Microsoft band was maybe 48 hours. So that's a pretty huge deal. Pretty huge deal.
And so and it's a different way of shipping software, too. This is this type of model, right, where... And what you're describing here is literally you come home with this inspiration, this whiz-bang inspiration, get down, create what you probably thought was a prototype, then you were like, you know what, this is actually good enough to ship, and just go with it. I think that's awesome. And if only, you know, I'd like to see more type of development like that. We see this actually a lot with hackathon culture. I don't know if you're familiar with that. We see a lot now. Imagine this, the younger guys, I know you said you got started around 18. Imagine this, the younger students in the high schools are regularly spending a weekend, right, building something and perhaps shipping it or letting it live on. So it's a new way of development. And I think being able to put those accolades in a public space, right, really lets it be tried and true what type of work you can be capable of accomplishing. That's awesome. So would you recommend this type of, like, you know, inspiration-driven development? Would you recommend that to developers out there today?
So not only would I recommend it, but I'd actually recommend that only as the motivation, believe it or not. Because if your motivation is to earn money, you will probably earn a lot of money doing it. You really will. There are areas in software development, whether it's corporate or consumer or not, that you can just absolutely make a great living
doing
it. It's
a lucrative career, yeah.
But if you don't love it, you will wish you weren't doing it. So this is what's different with me. Most of the people who have my experience and are my age now are managers or CIOs or CTOs of companies. They don't want to write software anymore. They're tired of writing software. I'm still doing it because I love writing software. So I think that's actually the only reason they should do it. Sort of love what you do what you love sort
sure.
of thing.
Yeah.
If you love writing even crummy software and you still love it, this is an opportunity for you to do all kinds of great things. All kinds of great things.
That's awesome. So for developers out there, like if you have that crazy idea, I guess the idea is to take it and start building on it. Run out there, see what you can do. Because I mean, at the end of the day, right? You might accidentally gain some experience in an emerging technology that may or may not take off, but you know that in the back of your mind, right, that you now have leveled up, right? You've gained some new experience, and you've made something that you wanted to happen become a reality, right?
Yes.
That's the cool thing about it.
And almost all of the next big things were accidents, right? I mean, they really were. People said, I have this little idea, and they worked on something for a few minutes, and then they look back, and 3 years later, wow, it's this, right? It's this huge thing. Those kind of things are starting with excited developers in their, you know, in their room at 2 a.m., right? Instead of playing Xbox, they decide to go on their, you know, computer and write some software because they know it can then work on Xbox.
So what's your biggest accidental discovery when developing?
So I think it was actually Outsider. So at my biggest accidental discovery. So I think the biggest accidental discovery was a rediscovery that I just really do love doing this for a living. You know, you'd think that I wouldn't. So I've had times in my career where I've said, you know, maybe I need to be done, right? What I've usually realized is because the project was boring, not because I don't like writing software.
Sure.
The other thing that I was a great accidental discovery was how much this is actually helping me connect with other people. See, this almost seems like the opposite of what you have, right? Typically picture someone who's writing software as a hermit,
not being
involved with other people.
Not seeing the sun for a few days.
So much of my app development has been related to people that I find myself being exposed to people, some very cool people all over the world. So I still have when I turn on my Xbox, I never play games, but I turn on my Xbox to watch Netflix and Amazon Prime and all that. Every time we turn on our Xbox, I see people come up on my Xbox that were actually people I met 4 or 5 years ago through Outsider.
Oh, wow.
That now they say, because you used to be able to share your gamer tag. So that's the other thing that's such a surprise is through writing software where nobody knows me, nobody can see me, I'm just all by myself, I've actually got all these great relationships with people all over the world that are just other people.
That is counterintuitive and very insightful. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Well, you know, with that, I think we've left the developers with some really great, you know, some we've walked through your experience, right? We've looked at some ways that you've done interesting things with your app to kind of engage user retention and that sort of thing. And I think you've given some really good advice for developers out there to maybe take the plunge and try out an emerging technology. So with the last thing, what's the last thing I guess you might want to say to some of your listeners out there, you know, some of the fans of actual Liquid Daffodil are out there, you know, that haven't seen the face, right? This has been a nice opportunity, I guess, to... what would you like to say to them?
I would say, I do it all for you.
That's awesome.
We do.
Well, there you have it. Scott Peterson of Liquid Daffodil. It's a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thanks, Paul. It's been great
and
being here.
Looking forward to that next big thing that's going to be coming out for the Microsoft Beta.
All right.
Sounds awesome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Take it easy, Channel 9. Thank you for joining us again. And we'll look forward to having you guys on the next one.